Oh, excellent. Okay. PL Perl. Who uses PL Perl? Who doesn't use PL Perl? Why are you here? Is it because you'd like to? Yeah, and you think it's interesting stuff? Okay. Well, that's good. So it means I'm not just preaching to the converted here. So there's a bunch of new features in PL Perl, which is what this talk is about. I'm going to be talking about some of the new features and some of the things the new features enable. I've kind of broken it down into these four areas: stuff that's of interest to ordinary users, a bit of internal information about what's changed, some things that are only relevant for DBAs, and then a look at using the MIT profiler. Okay, user stuff first. Big thing is there's a whole bunch of new built-ins. All the built-ins, several of them are based on, they're just thin wrappers around Postgres internal functions, and you'll recognize them. And some of the others come from the Perl world or just useful utilities. Quote literal and quote nullable and quote ident. So quote literal and quote nullable in these examples do exactly the same thing. They just quote a literal value in a way that makes it appropriate for use in a SQL statement. The only difference between the two comes when you use an undef, and I'll show that on the next slide. Quote ident quotes a string in a way that makes it usable as an identifier, which typically just means putting double quotes around it. But it only puts double quotes around it if it needs double quotes. So, for example, that foo, the first one there, doesn't need the double quotes because it's a simple ASCII string. What happens if you give them an undef? Well, quote literal just gives you back the undef. So generally, you don't want to use that. Generally, if you're passing a null that... If you're passing an undef that you want to put into a SQL statement, you generally want that turned into a null. So you use quote nullable instead. And quote ident just gives you back an empty string plus a warning if you have warnings turned on. A couple of extra ones. Byte A handling in Perl has been a bit of a pain, and the Postgres manual used to give a sort of nasty example chunk of code that you had to use whenever you wanted to fiddle around with Byte A. There's now built-ins to handle those. And these are just thin wrappers around the Postgres internals. So encoding Byte A, by default in Postgres 9, you get the new hex format, double backslash X, and then the hex. It also takes the octal. When you decode, you can pass in the old-fashioned style octal encoding. Something to bear in mind if you're using UTF-8 is that these functions are to do with encoding byte sequences. They don't understand about character sets. So if you encode a Unicode character, that's a smiley face Unicode character, you're going to get back the hex for the individual bytes within the character sequence. So when you decode that, you don't get back a Unicode string because decode byte A is all about giving you raw bytes, not characters. Just something to bear in mind. If you pass them empty strings, this is just a side effect of the way the internals work. You pass an empty string, you get back a backslash X with nothing after it. Pass in a backslash S, you get back an empty string. Give it an empty string, you get back an empty string. Give it an undef, you're going to get warnings if you have warnings turned on because it just regards that as an empty string. An extra little one that I thought was worth adding because we use it quite a bit or have used equivalent hand-coded ones is looks like number. If you're familiar with the DBI, you'll know there's a DBI looks like number utility, which is itself a thin wrapper around Perl's built-in looks like number function. And this is just the same, it's just a thin wrapper around that. So anything that looks like a number returns true, and if it doesn't look like a number, it returns false. Perfectly sensible. Something to watch out for, though, is it'll quite happily ignore leading and trailing spaces. And if you give it a number that has extra text after it, it'll say that's not a number. But if you use it in a mathematical expression, Perl will still extract the leading number from it, but you get a warning that it's not a number. Okay. Encode array. There's two encode arrays. There always used to be an encode array literal built in, but it was never advertised. It was just used internally. But I've exposed it and documented it. So encode array literal, you pass it an array reference, and you get back a Postgres style array string, a string literal. Array string literal is the right way to say it. And I've added another one, encode array constructor, which allows you to generate this sort of the array constructor syntax rather than the string array literal. Quite happy to cope with nested array structures, and you get back the appropriate strings. If you pass them something that isn't an array reference, then encode array literal just gives you the value back. It doesn't touch it at all. Encode array constructor quotes it. And if you think about it, that makes sense because you would normally manually quote the output of encode array literal because it's not quoted in itself. Encode array constructor is meant, the output of it is meant to be used directly in a SQL statement, so it's kind of already quoted. So that's what you, same thing happens if you pass it something that isn't an array reference. You get back something that's already quoted, suitable for direct use in a SQL statement. A big win here, new feature, you can require use a module if it's already been loaded. So how many people have used the begin import strict or the strict import? Is anyone using strict in their functions? Yeah, it's a bit of a pain, it's kind of ugly and it's now unnecessary. You can just say use strict. In fact, you can say use of any module that's already been loaded. By default, in 9.0, you get warnings, carp, and feature. And the feature module you get if you're using Perl 5.10 or later. David?
Can I use the new version, you know, use Perl 5.12.0?
Can you use the use 5.12.0?
Yeah.
To be honest, I don't actually know whether that syntax will work. I'm 99% sure it will. In fact, yes, it will. It will because What's happening behind the scenes is that the require opcode has been redirected to a bit of C code. And I think that C code has the logic in it to say he's asking for a number, so I'll just check if the Perl version is okay. So, yes, you can.
Right, yeah, then you lose the semantics in Perl 5.12 or that automatically loads strict for you.
Yes. But that's not a big deal in this scenario, I think. Okay. Now, this business about already loaded modules, you'll see why that's relevant later. Okay. Extra thing, I didn't add this one, but it's certainly very useful. If you have warnings or errors from your PL Perl code, sometimes it would tell you what function that was coming from, but most of the time it wouldn't. So you just get this warning, and you'd kind of know it was from your Perl code, but you wouldn't know where. But now you get an explicit context saying, I was in this Perl function. Okay, and if you're using CSV logging, there's a particular column where that context appears. And if you get warnings or errors while compiling a function, it'll say, while compiling this particular PL Perl function. And this is really useful when you have code where one PL Perl function calls another that calls another in, you know, some nested chain. And it can be a nightmare to work out where the messages were coming from. And now it's straightforward. Couple of other little things. End blocks are now run at the end of the session. You're not allowed to access the database during the end blocks currently. Originally, the way the implementation was worked out, it was felt that it would be unsafe, but now the implementation is safe, so that might be loosened in a later version if somebody can come up with a reasonable use case of what you'd want to do in an end block when your session is ending. The reason it's important for me personally is that the MIT profiler uses that to finish a profiling session. And I'll demonstrate that later. Something probably more relevant to most of you is that warnings generated from your Perl code are now logged as warnings rather than notices. And some people would kind of confuse why are my warnings coming out as notices? Because you might not even notice the notice if you didn't have the right warning level set. So now the warnings from Perl are warnings. So you might find in 9.0 you get a whole lot more warnings in your log than you were expecting. You just need to go in and find the calls and fix them. But it's some people like to turn off warnings in production. I prefer to leave them on and fix the calls. Okay, so that's the user level stuff. Any questions on those things? Are they useful? Is it nodding? Mm-hmm. Yep, thumbs up, great. Internals. The safe module is no longer used for PLPerl. PLPerl used to be implemented using, the security of the PLPerl language used to be implemented using the safe module. And that's now been removed because the safe module is basically insecure. It's not safe. So as you probably know, in the last week, there's been a security release of Postgres. Who has installed it? Who hasn't installed it? Okay. If you have untrusted users who are allowed to write PLPerl code, then your system is insecure. You should upgrade at once. Okay, PLPerl subroutines are now given names. This was supposed to be handy for internal tools. In practice, it turns out not to be as useful as I'd hoped. So the profiler, for example, has to do it in another way. Something slightly more relevant is if you're working with encodings, Unicode, whatever, there can be circumstances where you might accidentally return strings that are not UTF-8 encoded, especially if you're working with Byte. Whenever you return a value from a PLPerl subroutine now, it'll validate that that is in the correct encoding as far as it's able. So that normally means if you're returning garbage that should be UTF-8, it'll catch it and tell you. And there's been a whole bunch of internal code refactorings and cleanups, and some of which lead to greater performance. The removal of the safe module actually significantly reduces the overhead of calling PLPerl functions. It's now about 3 times faster. Okay. Any questions on those? Okay. There we go. Who's a DBA here? Who kind of runs the database? Who's not a DBA? Who's not putting their hand up? Okay. Thank you. A mix. Okay. DBA stuff. Really, the only significant thing from the DBA's perspective are these new config variables. 3 of them. One that runs some Perl code when the Perl interpreter is initialized. One that runs when the code, when the interpreter is specialized for use for the PLPerl language, and one for the PLPerl U language. These can only be set by the superuser or the postgres.conf file. And the code that you put in those variables can't access the database. And the reason for that is that these may run at strange times because the interpreter is loaded on demand. So you might be in the middle of a transaction, and if the code here accessed the database and there was an error, then you'd get sort of unexpected instability. So I want to just walk through the timeline of in the life of a Perl interpreter. Because there's a significant thing to bear in mind if you want to use, or you do use, shared preload libraries. So the interpreter is normally created on demand. The first time you use the PLPerl language in any way, the first time you create a function, the first time you call a function. So a Perl interpreter is magicked into existence. And it immediately runs some bootstrap code just to kind of integrate it with the Postgres server. And it then runs the PLPerl.onInit Perl code. Now, if you've used shared preload libraries, you can. This will happen in the Postmaster. Now, it may be that in some environments you want to load in a whole bunch of modules. Let's say you're using a lot of modules currently, and you have an environment where you're connecting. Users are connecting frequently. You're not using a connection pooling. Then if you don't load modules into the Postmaster, then every time a client connects, they have to load the modules and get set up, and that's a lot of overhead. So the way around that is some people in this kind of scenario have used shared preload libraries to load the modules into the Postmaster. Now, that's not recommended because the Postmaster needs to be very stable and you shouldn't go there, but there's a few particular circumstances where it can be useful. So this PLPerl on init code runs when the Perl interpreter is initialized. So you just need to bear in mind that that might be happening inside the Postmaster if you've configured it that way. Now, when you come to use the particular language, PLPerl or PLPerl U, the interpreter that has been created gets specialized for that particular use. If you're not using shared preload libraries, that just happens immediately on demand. The interpreter is created and then immediately used for whatever language it is that you're using first time. When it's specialized, and let's just take the PL-Perl example, because PL-Perl-U, you know, there's basically very little to do. PL-Perl, it loads the modules that I've said are preloaded by default, strict, warnings, features, and cap. I didn't mention that one. Then, having loaded those modules, it restricts the Perl operators, what you're allowed to run. Now, this is where things like open are turned off. So you can't compile Perl code that uses unsafe operators. And this is the way PL-Perl has always worked, and this is the way PL-Perl has provided the security. If you try writing a bit of PL-Perl code that opens a file or does another unsafe operation, it gets caught at compile time and you get an error. So although we're no longer using safe, the same restriction applies and the operators are disabled. Then the Dynaloader package is deleted because you don't want people to be able to load in dynamic libraries, which would then possibly open security holes. And then the PL-Perl on init code runs. So the important thing here is that the PL-Perl on init code runs after the interpreter has been locked down. So it's restricted. So that code can actually do for very little. It's reliant on the PL-Perl on init code to set things up. So there's relatively little use for the PL-Perl on init, and I'll explain how it came to be that way in a minute. Finally, having done all these things, last thing, the database access is enabled before the interpreter is freed up to be used for whatever it is it got created for.
When you say database access is enabled, does that mean wrappers for database, like SPI functions?
The SPI functions, yeah. So if you try to run any SPI functions here, I think actually the SPI functions don't exist in the interpreter. Kind of the very last thing it does is to bring them into existence. If you try to call the SPI functions in an end block, it'll just say you're not allowed to. I think it throws an error. So PL-Perl on init. This is the big thing. This is the magic that's very powerful, and it should be used with caution. Typical use case, you would use libraries. Let's say you're in a company, you have a library of Perl code that you want to be able to access. Maybe there's some business logic in some Perl code, and you want to be able to load it into the Postgres interpreter to use it from your PL-Perl code. So first thing you want to do is typically tell Perl that your library of application code is somewhere, and then use some modules. If that line starts getting a bit long, you know, I don't know what the limit is, but it isn't very large, what you should do is just change it to require a Perl file and just put whatever instructions you need in there. But there's a big security risk here. Any modules that you load in here will be available for use by PL-Perl code. So you need to audit everything that you're loading. Because if let's say you load a module that has a dependency on another module, that has a dependency on another module that, for example, loads POSIX.pm for some reason, into your Perl interpreter will be loaded the POSIX extension. And the POSIX extension is full of all sorts of evil, insecure things, which would then be available for anyone who can use PL-Perl code. So you need to avoid that. You need to pay attention. So what you can do is to find out what has actually been loaded. There's a nice module, devel trace load, and I'll demonstrate using that. It's very easy to use, and it just dumps out at the end of the session a list of all the modules that have been loaded and where they got loaded from. What was it that triggered the loading? So, best practice for writing PL-Perl code if you want to use external modules. Don't assume the modules have been loaded. If you're a DBA and you load some modules and you tell your developers or you tell yourself that the modules are available, it might be tempting to refer to the module directly, so package name, ; function, without explicitly using it. But if you do that, then you'll get unpleasant failures if you run that code on another database instance that doesn't have the same configuration. You know, where your postgres.conf doesn't have the on init that loads those same modules. So you should have explicit use statements in your PL-Perl code wherever you're using a module, wherever you're relying on a module being loaded, you should explicitly mention that. So if it isn't loaded, if it hasn't been loaded in that instance, you'll get a very clear error message straight away. For PLPerl U code, that'll just actually load the module, because PLPerl U is unrestricted. For PLPerl code, it'll just check that the module was loaded by your DBA's initialization.
Do you mind showing the previous slide again, just so you have what you used in an old trace
log? Okay. I'll give you an example of that in a few minutes. Okay. These slides will all be available online, and I'm doing a screencast as well. Okay. So for PLPerl, by actually explicitly including a use statement in any functions that require a particular module, you'll get a clear immediate failure, which would be very handy when you try to run the code on some system that doesn't have the module loaded. So let's look at on PLPerl init. The original idea for this was that an individual developer, for example, going to run a test suite, might want to modify the settings of the Perl interpreter that they're using. So I envisaged it as being usable by PG options, where you would set, for example, a debug variable in the interpreter. And I thought that would be a really useful thing. But along the way, it turned out there was a problem. Tom Lane spotted the fact that you could use this mechanism to influence the behavior of a PLPerl function that is security definer, that has the security definer attribute. Does anyone have security definer functions using PLPerl language? Okay, good, because they're just fundamentally insecure. If you don't trust the users who you've given use of the PLPerl language to, then you can't trust security definer in the PLPerl language, because the Perl interpreter is too porous. It's too easy to influence the control flow. So it would be easy for somebody to subvert the security definer function and make it do whatever they wanted, because they could get it to run their own code when it runs. So I should do a blog post or something about that and raise it on the Postgres security list, because I think, personally, my view is that PLPerl code shouldn't be allowed to be used for security definer functions. So it turns out the bottom line here is that on PLPerl init isn't actually very useful at all. Okay, any questions on all that? Because I've kind of buzzed through it quickly.
Just a note on the previous slide, there's a thread raging on PG Hackers today about defining what the restricted and unrestricted PL should be able to do, and I mentioned something relating to that.
Right. Okay.
Emulating your good things and trying to stay away from the bad.
Yeah, well, if only we can work out what the good and the bad are. Yeah, the issue of what is safe and what isn't. So the difference between PLPerl and PLPerl U, not very clearly defined. And the difference between trusted and untrusted variants of all the languages that have those isn't well defined.
Yes. Try and fix that.
Yeah, which is great. And greater clarity would be a wonderful thing there. And this change to enable this on Perl init and the loading of external modules is going to make the Perl language more attractive and more open and more widely used for things where you're loading external modules. So I can imagine there's going to be more interest in exploring the boundaries of what's possible. So, for example, using sockets. Any other questions? If I stare at someone for a while, I can usually tickle out a question. No? Okay. Let's talk about profiling then. Who's interested in speed? Who's not interested in speed? There you go. That's a better one. You're not interested? Okay, I have to talk to you later. Okay, MIT Prof. Who's heard of MIT Prof? Who's not heard of MIT Prof? Oh, phew, fabulous. Okay. Who hasn't used it? Okay. This is good. MyTprof. MyTprof is a source code profiler. It's the source code profiler. All other source code profilers should be wheeled out and put in the trash can. And if there's... I've given some talks on MyTprof that explain what's wrong with the others and demonstrate the goodness. So what I'm going to do here is just give you an example of how to use it and demonstrate it, a live demo, which is taking my life in my hands here. So one way you can enable it for Postgres is to use this nice little module called PostgresQL PLPerl MyTprof, and you can put it in your Postgres conf file. Realistically, though, it kind of makes more sense to put it in a Perl 5 opt variable. Now, this is a great trick that a lot of people don't know, or very few people know, depending on your point of view. The Perl 5 opt variable can be used to influence the Perl interpreter inside Postgres. And you can do all sorts of evil things. It's a powerful weapon to be used for good or evil, depending on your needs. So here, I'm telling the Perl interpreter inside Postgres that when it fires up, it should load in the MyTprof module, which will auto-magically enable profiling for that session, and when the session ends, you will get a nice profile data file. Can't get much simpler than that. Now, by default, the profiling will be enabled straight away. And maybe you don't want that. Maybe you don't want it enabled all the time for all the users on that server. So you can set the MyTprof environment variable, which you use to sort of pass options to the profiler. And you can just set that start equals no, which is don't start. And then when you, in your particular session, want to do some profiling, you can say db enable profile. I haven't measured the cost of having profiling loaded but not enabled, but it's going to be very cheap. So I wouldn't suggest you run it in production, but I don't think it would be a problem if you did. So the advantage of this is that if you have some test server that's getting hit by lots of different developers, you won't be spitting out profile files for every session. You'll only get a profile for the sessions that particularly ask for it. So where do these profile files go? Well, by default, they go into the PG data directory called mytprof.out with a PID attached. You can use the mytprof environment variable to get the files to go wherever you like, anywhere writable by the Postgres server. And then to generate a report, mytprof HTML, and give it the report file. Okay, let's take a look. Time for a live demo. I take my life in my hands. Okay, so here's Postgres. What I'm going to do here is restart the Postgres server, and I'm going to load MyTprof, and I'm also going to load devel traceload, so we see what modules get loaded. And after restarting the server, I'm going to delete any MyTprof data files, and oh look, I'm deleting core files. Haven't needed to actually delete core files for a while, but there you go. Okay, so there's our Postgres server running. Over here, we have some random piece of PLPerl code that you can't see because the screen is off the edge. Okay, how's that? So this is, what I should show you is over here, Postgres configuration file, which again is off the edge of the screen. So down the bottom there you can see I'm telling Postgres that I want to set PLPerl configuration variables, and I'm just loading a digest MD6 module, which is like MD5, only better. And I'm just using it as an example because Postgres doesn't have MD6 built in yet. So here's our bit of PLPerl code, and you notice this is PLPerl, not PLPerlU, and that now I can use that module that I loaded in the initialization file. Okay. So I just use it, and then I'm creating an MD6 object. I'm caching it so I don't have to keep recreating it. And what this function does is it just adds in more data to the MD6 that I'm creating. And then MD6 hex just gives you the hex value, the current hex value that you've accumulated. And then here, just to exercise this, I'm generating 100,000 numbers, calling md6add for each one. I'm just getting a count for the sake of not generating a bunch of output. Call md6. So there, I've generated I've defined two PL-PERL functions. I'm calling one of them 100,000 times, calling the other one. Now, I'm calling these directly from Postgres. And then here, I've got another PL-PERL function that I just do exactly the same thing. So I'm calling it 100,000 times from a bit of SQL statement that's running inside a PL-PERL function. And then I call that to fire it off. So this MD6 add will get called 200,000 times. Okay, that all clear? Any questions about what we're going to do? Okay, let's give it a whirl. So here, I'm deleting the old MYTProf data file, and I'm going to run that script. It takes about 10 seconds. And then, so that's the first set of 100,000 calls done. And then the next set of 100,000 calls done. Ooh, look, that generated lots of output. Da, 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 da. Actually, I'll do that again because the output got... there we go. The output got mangled there. I'll show you the output from the devel traceload. You may remember we had the configuration that we started the Postgres server up had MYTProf and devel traceload. So what happens when the session ends, devel traceload gives you this nice dump. So this is showing you all the Perl modules that have been loaded and why they got loaded. Okay, so base was loaded by digest MD6 carp. Carp heavy, digest base, feature strict, Unicode heavy, UTF-8. Okay, if you're loading a Perl module like your own stuff or especially stuff from CPAN, you really want to know what else is getting loaded because you need to check all of those things for security because anything you load is potentially a backdoor. Okay, you know, it might be it's an innocent opening that could be exploited by anybody who has access to the PL-PERL language. Access loader isn't suspicious because access loader is just a wrapper around Dynaloader, and you notice Dynaloader isn't there. Dynaloader gets deleted. Yeah. So there you go. So the principle here is that what Postgres is giving you is secure. If you choose to load stuff in, that's your lookout, and you need to take responsibility for that. Okay, so now we have in our PG data directory, we have this profile file. And let's generate a report. So it reads in the file, generates a lot of HTML, and abracadabra, ka-ching. Here we go. Now, isn't that pretty?
Pretty.
Pretty. So, this is a performance profile for your Postgres session. And that's telling you that it took about 10 seconds, it executed that many statements, that many subroutine calls, that many source files, that many string evals. And here is the top 15 subroutines out of 173. And they're ordered by the exclusive time. So you spent 2.38 seconds, which was 35% of the time was spent in the MD6 add. And it gives you the inclusive time. So the exclusive time is the time just in the code for that subroutine. The inclusive time is the code in that subroutine and everything it called. Okay. So the one thing that MD6 add called was the digest MD6 add. So you see there's 1.4, and if you add together the 3.8 and the 1.04, and you get that, basically. So we spent 18.6% of the time doing this SPI query. Time in MD6. Everything down here is pretty much the overhead for traceload and the UTF-8 getting bootstrapped. Okay, you can see, and that's actually fairly expensive. So it's an interesting observation about the cost of using Postgres, of using PL-PERL, but you pay that just once, so it's not significant. Okay, and then down here we have, I'll ignore that stuff for now. Here's a list of all the files, and so that can be interesting in itself. It gives you another view over what's being loaded. This is ordered by the exclusive time of the statements in those files. Excuse me. Now, this minus E might look a bit weird, but that minus E is the way Perl thinks of the bootstrap code. Whenever the Postgres interpreter says, please eval this chunk of Perl code. That's when the Perl interpreter starts up and runs its own bootstrap code and it runs the PL Perl on underscore init, it's counted as this source file. For the other evals where the Postgres interpreter says eval this, it's counted as this unknown eval invoker. We'll look at those shortly. Let's go back here. So let's actually look at this MD6. Okay, so here's the source code. And you'll notice that looks very similar to that. So it's that source code for this function. But what's happened is the MIT profiler has annotated it with performance information. So here you can see it's spent 4.87 seconds inside this subroutine. And it was called 100,000 times from this place and 100,000 times from this place. So this place here, this main runtime line 0 of E, is the Postgres interpreter itself making the call. So that's when you call directly from SQL. But this one, you can see it was called by SPI exec query. So what you're seeing here is this call down here. So where your PL Perl code has executed a SQL statement, and the SQL statement has executed a PL Perl function, MITProf shows you that whole stack. So this is really useful that you can see who is calling your code and how often. And if you click on that, ka-ching, it takes you to the caller. Okay, and if you look at the caller, you can see I spent so long calling SPI query and so long calling MD6add. So you can see what your code is doing. Now this exec query might be some code that you've built up. It might be some dynamically generated SQL statement. But this will tell you which other PL Perl functions that get executed by that. Now there's a slight oddity here in the way the numbers work, and I haven't worked out quite why that is. It's to do with the fact that Perl gets re-entered. Okay, yes. Thank you. I should explain that. That's the OID. It's the OID of the function. And it's there to make it unique, but also to avoid clashing with the built-ins and things. Okay, so that'll change if ever you delete and recreate a function. And this stuff here, this package main, and this stuff, and this stuff, is all just sort of infrastructure that you can safely ignore. What you see over here, actually let's go back to this one because there's more going on. What you see over here is how many statements were executed on that line. So here that line was executed 200,000 times. This one was 400,000 times because it's got the two statements here so that you get the 200,000 twice. And you get how much time was spent on the line, and if you hover you get the percentage, the average rather, two microseconds. It's pretty damn fast. You'll notice this large time here on the return undef. What's happening is that the profiler is saying, okay, I'm going to start this return statement, and I'm going to start the clock, and I'm going to keep the clock running until I hit the next Perl statement, okay, or until I leave the Perl in interpreter. So what you're seeing is the time spent sort of getting out of Perl back into the caller. So it's the time it takes to arrive back at the next statement in the caller. So where you've been called from Perl code, like this, it's got to get all the way back through the Postgres execution engine, which is why that last line shows a bigger time. Okay. What else should I show you? Oh, yeah, so the use, you can see here, these calls only happen at compile time. The use turns into a begin that contains a require and an import. So that's the begin. The require triggers that because we have traceload enabled, and then you can see the import. Any questions?
Is the add to because
The app 2, that's it. MIT Prof mangles the name to make them unique because you could have multiple begins. Yeah, so it's giving you the line number, you know, the begin at line 2. Now, what else do you get? Up here, you get the subroutines. Let's go back over here. So, if we look at the whole subroutine table, it's pretty colors. The colors, by the way, are based on the median average deviation, which you can look up on Wikipedia. I'll just pretend I understand it, and hopefully nobody will notice. Tables is sortable. Ooh. The P and the F are the number of different places the subroutine was called from, the number of different files it was called from. Usually not terribly relevant. Number of different calls, all good sexy stuff. But if you really want sexy, then we should look at the tree map. Ooh. Now, the tree map isn't terribly interesting unless you have lots of CPAN modules or packages and stuff, because it's what it's showing you is the packages. Okay, it's actually kind of a bit big. Scrolling off the bottom, yeah. Actually, no, it just kind of looks that way. This is showing you very dramatically that most of the time is spent in the ad, and SPI exec query, and MD6 ad. So it's showing you very visually where your time is getting spent. You can also actually drill down on these. If you click, you drill down the package hierarchy. So if you're using CPAN modules, this looks fabulous. You get a lovely detailed tree map, and you can just drill down, and people go ooh and ah. Okay, I think we're about done. Anybody have any questions about that? No. Okay, shoot. Yep.
That would, when you fire up Postgres, that loads the Perl interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
Is there then just one Perl interpreter in memory and all such, and hook up with that, or?
Okay. The question was about the life cycle of a Perl interpreter when you're using load shared libraries.
Yes.
Okay. The postmaster, when you connect and create a new session, forks itself, clones the process. So if there's a Perl interpreter that has been created inside the postmaster, you get in your back end, your personal session back end, you get that pre-configured Perl ready for your use.
So you save the time and not have to load
it. Exactly, yep. So if you're in an environment where you have a lot of Perl code you want to load, you can get the postmaster to do that once, and then it's preloaded when the postmaster forks for you. Yeah, but it's not recommended for a bunch of stability reasons and whatever.
Is the Perl interpreter, how much extra weight does that add to the
How big is the Perl interpreter? It's about this big.
That seems pretty big.
Well, the Postgres is, you know, that big. I don't know, is the short answer. Not huge, but not tiny. Does that help?
I think it's pointed me kind of in the right direction.
Great. I mean, what I'd do is I'd start, I'd connect to Postgres, measure the size of the process, use a bit of Perl, measure the size of the process again, and go, well, look, you know, A minus B, yeah, or B minus A. So you could see back in the profile that there was a non-trivial cost, for example, in calling the UTF-8 code to get that set up. So you're paying that cost whenever you connect to the back end. But whenever you connect to the back end, you're paying a whole bunch of costs just to get the process set up. So anybody who says, my system is slow because I'm making lots of connections, you go, well, there's your problem. You know, you should be using a connection pooling. So it's kind of easy for them to want to point the finger at something that's making them slow, but it's the wrong approach. And if they're really stuck that way, then load shared libraries is one option. Yeah.
You also didn't mention my favorite line of the overall change, but only because Ooh. I wrote the only semi-usable patch for it.
Okay.
The anonymous code blocks now have an MPL for it. So you just
yes.
create a function and you fill it with code and it's a named object that you recall. But you can also
Thank you.
Do this in Perl and throw it
Yep. Thank you. I didn't mention that because I was kind of thinking of that as a Postgres change rather than a PL-Perl change, but it is really a PL-Perl change because it required support. So yes, very important feature. You can now just type chunks of Perl into your session or use them in your application. You just say do string chunk of Perl code language PL-Perl. So whenever you just want to fire off a little something or just check a little something, you used to have to write a procedure and then call the procedure, and now you don't, you just say do chunk of Perl code, and very handy.
Like
so,
if you
wanted thank
to
you.
The interpreter to load to see how much bigger the process was without creating an object.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and another point about the interpreters is that if you're using both PL-Perl and PL-Perl-U, you get two interpreters. So, because they need to be separate, so they're isolated for security. Yeah, because obviously PL-Perl-U can do untrusted things. PL-Perl can't. But the effect of that, there's an interesting interaction there in the load shared libraries creates an interpreter in the postmaster. But that interpreter gets used for whichever language you happen to first use in your client session. Yeah, and when you if you're using both languages, you're still in the back end going to create at least one Perl interpreter because you can't pre-create both of them in the postmaster. But you know, not many people would need to, but it's something to be aware of. Okay. Any more questions?
What would be the use case for wanting to switch back and forth between PL-Perl-U and PL-Perl in a single session?
What would be the use case for using PL-Perl and PL-Perl-U in a single session? There's actually very good use cases. The point about PL-Perl is that you can only do trusted operations in it. So it's a language that you can allow your untrusted users to play with. But let's say that you want to load some CPAN module that opens files and does network connections and all that stuff. What you do is you load that module into your PL-Perl-U interpreter. You create some functions in the PL-Perl-U language to provide safe access to whatever the functionality is. And then in your application, you call your PL-Perl functions for the normal stuff, and then you call your PL-Perl-U function to do the thing that needs to be, thing that needs to take extra care about security. Yeah. So it's quite common to be using both. In environments that need to do something insecure, you would normally do as little as possible in the PL-Perl-U and do the rest in PL-Perl. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions? I think we're done then. Thank you.
Hi. Nick Avatar.
Nick, hi.
I hadn't realized you created Devel and LightDProf. I wanted to thank you for it because it's made my life much easier.
Oh, great.
I only
thank
discovered
you.
It a year or two ago, but it's been a godsend.
Yeah.
I've
yeah,
been using VDI for about 14 years, and that's been extremely useful too. So.
Right. Well, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, I get a lot of thanks for MITProf recently.
Oh, yeah,
people love just
it's
being able to.
It's such a joy to work with. It's, I've solved a lot of optimization problems with it.
Great.
Discovered a lot that I didn't, a lot that I never realized about Perl in terms of where some of the hot spots occur.
Yes, so it can be surprising.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really opened my eyes to a lot of things.
Yes.
I've found a lot of things, like, you know, places that I'd overlooked using the slash O flag on regular expressions and things like that.
Yes.
And I was just shocked at what a difference it could make. Yes. Things like that.
Yeah, and it shows up so clearly. Okay.
Good.
You're welcome.
Simply not had any reason to use it before.
Yeah.
And then I changed jobs and they use Postgres, and so suddenly I'm messing around with Postgres.
Sweet. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, as long as I stay working there, then I'll be messing with Postgres.
Oh, great. Yeah, it was, so as I started fiddling with the do stuff, it was nice to kind of be able to write a patch that, you know, at least sort of worked, even though I could see clearly that there were several parts of the code that I didn't understand and wasn't willing to put the time into to understand, and then just throw it over the wall and watch like Andrew Dunstan and everybody else just work it out.
Unplug the gray cable.
Unplug the gray one?
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
There's a lot that gets done that way when you just kind of, you get it close enough to done that somebody figures it's
yeah. So that's good. Let's polish that up.
So how does the non